This is Pure Decking for April the 10th, 2014. This is show that stuff that this is the show about stuff that interests me. The first intro was better. Damn it. Expanding into a police state, information security, and pointing and laughing at my own mistakes as I fuck up the first recording of the show. So I'm Morps, and tonight we have the Sard, the Suave, and the BSV. Gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
I suppose we ought to...
Internets.
Hello, internets.
This is deja vu.
Yeah, no kidding. So, playing the part of Sard tonight will be Suave. No, wait, that's not right. we're going to rearrange your handles. Play the part of the person whose card you get. So.
Good day, mate. It's mighty frosty up here in Canada land.
Wait a minute. What?
Yeah, did you see that?
Today, Sard is everyone.
I just crossed the streams.
No, that's not crossing the streams. I'm pretty sure that was just going full retard, but...
Sard, we're going to have to take you in for a full evaluation and make sure your brain's working.
And by evaluation, he's going to cut your brain open, pull out your brain... Or cut your skull open, pull out your brain, and poke at it with a stick.
You're not supposed to tell him that!
I would expect nothing less from the mad scientist.
Okay. Well, just to run down it again, I am drinking some Robot Revolution Ale. That's not ale, that's stout. Damn it. I really am screwed up now. This has got me all discombobulated. We sit there and did 10 minutes of show. So I'm drinking Robot Revolution Stout. And Sard, what did you say you were drinking?
I have a shock top.
You have a shock top. BSV, what are you drinking to keep us from falling into the sun since Madman's away today?
Angry Orchard Hard Cider.
Angry Orchard. And Suave...
Delicious, delicious water.
Well, you know, I understand it's rare where you live, so. Anyways. It's like, you know, at least when it's in liquid form, and, you know, fairly common in ice form, right?
Well, yeah. What my house is made out of, don't you know?
Because, you know, I've confused Canada with the Arctic Circle, so.
Well, part of it's in the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure not many people live in that part. So, I mean, my understanding was most Canadians were right there poised on the border ready for the invasion. So
probably.
I mean, I wouldn't bat with
them. Think Suave's quietness is him plotting to take you out since he revealed his other secrets.
I'm not in the north. I'm fine. I've got like, you know, four or five layers of state worth of buffer. So
we're gonna send our attack beavers down south there.
Hey, I'll see them coming. I'll see them coming. I'll have my shotgun. I'll have my bourbon, and I'll be all kinds of happy.
Don't make us burn down the White House again.
There's so many jokes right now, and I just realized half of them could be so misinterpreted. It's like, go ahead, I don't care about it. It's like, I don't like the guy that's in it, go ahead. It's like, wait a minute, that might have a... Why are you handing me a ghost costume? That's not...
For any government listening to it, we mean the house that just painted white down the street, not in the Capitol.
Yeah. For anyone who hasn't caught on yet, it's a joke. All right. Let's get right into it here. So I'm assuming everyone by now is aware of the OpenSSL bug that everybody's calling Heartbleed. Heartbleed is a interesting vulnerability in OpenSSL. It has its own dedicated website, and that actually got thrown up fairly quickly, heartbleed.com. For anybody who's really confused, we are not talking about a medical condition. That's something else. Heart bleeding means go to the doctor. Heart bleed means, update OpenSSL. But pretty much, so the slug from heartbleed.com here, the Heartbleed bug is a serious vulnerability in the popular OpenSSL cryptographic software library. The weakness allows the stealing of information protected under normal circumstances by SSL TLS encryption used to secure the internet. SSL TLS provides communication security and privacy over the internet for applications such as web, email, IM, and some VPNs. The Heartbleed bug allows anyone on the internet to read the memory of systems protected by the vulnerable version of OpenSSL. This compromises the secret keys used to identify the service providers and encrypt the traffic, the names and passwords of the users, and the actual content. This allows attackers to eavesdrop on communications still directly from the services and users and to impersonate services and users. Now, Vox.com actually has a very nice article explaining exactly how this vulnerability works. So, and it has little visual representations, so that might be handy for you. But now I'll have that link in the show notes. But to explain it, the way it works, SSL provides the functionality of a heartbeat. It's basically a ping within the SSL tunnel. I say tunnel, but pretty much when you set up an SSL connection, you and the server exchange crypto keys, you set up a one-time key that's used for the duration of that communication session, and then anything you send to that port on the server is encrypted with the key, anything the server sends back is encrypted, and occasionally you want to make sure that connection's still alive. Usually with web pages, that's not such a big deal, but if you're doing like an SSL VPN, you know, it matters, or if you're doing long transfers or whatever. So the SSL spec provides for this heartbeat. And the way it works is after you've established your SSL connection, right, everything's supposed to be encrypted between you and the server. And so you send this heartbeat packet. It has pretty much the packet itself, which is indicating it's a heartbeat. It has a short message. It's a randomly chosen message usually. Just a couple of chunks of character that your computer remembers. And then the length of the message. So to make things nice and simple, you know, if the message that your machine picked was, I don't know, the word pipe, P-I-P-E, right? So it would say, you know, this is a heartbeat packet going out to the server. You know, my message is pipe and its length is 4. You know, it's 4 characters, right? And it's assumed because you're talking to the server encrypted, all your data is encrypted, that only the server you were talking to can decode that message and respond to it correctly. So the response to a heartbeat is basically the server sending an acknowledgement and the message you sent back to confirm that you're talking to the same server. And, in cryptographic theory, that sounds pretty good. You know, you're sending in a message in the encrypted tunnel. If it gets the same one back, well, hey, only the server I was talking to should have been able to decrypt that, so everything should be good. Where things get interesting is, let's say you custom craft your heartbeat packet so that instead of saying the word pipe has a length of 4, it has a length of 64 kilobytes. You will get back your message in the vulnerable versions of OpenSSL. You'll get back your heartbeat packet response with the message, and then, you know, and then almost 64 kilobytes of whatever was in memory behind your message. Oops.
Wow. Yeah, that's bad.
That's very bad.
So, you know, it's almost 64K. It's 64K minus the length of whatever the message block you sent was, which is not very long. So, now, first up, you know, from as far as vulnerabilities go, this one is interesting because you're not going to crash the server with it. It's a memory read condition. It's not a buffer overflow. It's not like you're going to crash anything out. So that's handy. But from a data security standpoint, this is horrible because you have no idea what 64 kilobytes of memory this thing is going to return. It just happens to wherever your message happened to land in memory on this server. And if it's a very busy server, you could be getting a lot. If it's a server that's not very busy, has a lot of empty memory at the time you do the packet, you know, you might get your message and a whole bunch of null. I mean, just a whole bunch of nothing. And when I was testing it, on vulnerable machines that didn't have much going on them, you know, you'd get back 64 kilobytes of empty space with maybe one line in it of, you know, just something was going on the server. But on very busy servers, you would see the contents of web pages that were being requested by other users. You would see sessions, cookie strings. So if you knew what you were doing with session stealing, you could theoretically pluck that out, pop it in your browser, and steal in, you know, do a session hijack. Now, I will admit, I've never actually managed to get a session hijack to work successfully outside of a lab. I've been able to set up a vulnerable website and a vulnerable, you know, in a client VM and then another client VM and do the session hijack. But on an actual network, I always got like session timed out or, you know, just a, you know, invalid session ID, stuff like that. And maybe it's just me and I didn't put enough effort into it or whatever. But I've personally never been able to get the damn thing to work. But supposedly, if you know what you're doing with session hijacking, you can steal the sessions from these memory, you know, these little micro memory dumps and actually, you know, I don't know, Gmail, do it to somebody else. You know, so suddenly you're logged into somebody else's Gmail. Now, that doesn't get you their password. That just gets you a session. But, hell, a session's usually enough to reset a password, so.
Right.
There's that. Now, Vox's explanation is pretty good because they have pictures. So that, if you didn't understand what I was talking about explaining how this worked, I don't know. How clear was that to you guys? Mud?
Crystal.
No, that makes sense. Seemed
relatively clear.
But I think, like you were saying, it's random memory. Wherever, whatever random 64K that's after that password, that gets sent. So, like you said, you know, sending a, trying to, you keep, on a web server, you can't say, oh, here, look, Joe's logged in. Let me shadow his session. It's completely random, right?
Right. Well, I wouldn't say completely random. It's just wherever the next chunk of free memory that your machine's going to call up and hand to OpenSSL for a new connection is.
Right, but so, you can't say, you know, target this little chunk of memory.
It's not. It's certainly not practical to try to make predictions. But here's the fun part. Because like I was saying, it's a memory read condition. You're not going to be knocking over servers with this. There's absolutely nothing preventing you from, say, making the request packet 100 times and just logging whatever you get back.
Yeah.
Okay, so you would actually, I mean, you could like
pretty much
memory map a whole server then.
Not necessarily, because there's no guarantee that you're not going to get the same chunk of memory back over and over and over again.
Yeah, but if you did it enough times, you would think that maybe you could map all of it.
You'd be, theoretically you could, but you're also not getting address information back, so you don't know where, you know, it's not like you know what chunk of memory this was.
That's true.
So there's a lot of guesswork involved. But in my own testing of this, because I've spent the past couple of days at work testing this and seeing the extent of the vulnerability, and I will tell you, as a matter of fact, using this vulnerability, I was able to gain administrator credentials to a couple of email-related systems.
Plain text username and password just sitting there in memory.
Well, the password was. The username was in a different part of it, but yes.
Okay.
I mean, they weren't like, it wasn't like right next to each other, stupid simple to find.
Yeah.
But you could throw a stone from there. I mean, it was not difficult. I mean, I would not put it past Skitties to be able to pull information out of this. So.
Interesting.
But yeah, I was able to pull some clear text credentials and get into systems with it. So this is a fairly serious problem.
So would it just be clear text stuff that would be vulnerable then?
No.
Would the hashed stuff processed?
In anything, think about the way a computer works. Anytime you read the hard drive, what it's doing is it's copying it into memory before the processor can actually get at it. And this is dumping memory randomly. So, anything in active use on the system, that could be your SSL keys, that could be certificates, that could be user credentials, that could be database information, anything that passes through a machine.
As long as it's shorter than 64K.
Or you manage to do multiple dumps and get all of it.
and add it all up. That's what I'm assuming. Like, if someone has a picture open or something like that, if you were able to grab all those chunks out of memory, you could reassemble it, right?
That'd be a lot of work, but yes.
Yeah, but I mean, that would kind of seem like the next logical step.
Yeah.
Abuse.
It would be, but here's the best part. OpenSSL provides zero functionality that I've been able to find for logging heartbeat packets.
Okay.
Ooh.
So
you have no idea if this has happened.
It makes zero records. It doesn't crash the service. The only way to know what's been happening is to have some sort of an IDS/IPS in front of the box looking for malformed packets, and nobody knew to look for it till yesterday. Or, well, the 7th, actually, I should say.
What I don't understand is I was reading on this, that this is like a 2-year-old bug.
It was.
Why is it just now surfacing?
Because it was just now found.
I thought they found it like I thought someone said they found it like 2011.
Well, that's okay. The bug was introduced into OpenSSL in December of 2011 and was actually published in OpenSSL released 1.0.1 on the 14th of March in 2012. And then they released 1.0.1G on the 7th of April 2014, and that fixed the bug. So for whatever reason, the length testing wasn't, you know, if you gave it that bad length, it wasn't deciding, okay, this is a malformed packet and throwing it away or returning an error. It would accept it and then just return the data. So it's got to be, I haven't seen the code, so I'm not sure exactly what kind of error it was that introduced this. But it's obviously an unintentional thing, and it was only OpenSSL. It's not every SSL server out there. Microsoft's
right.
was not affected. Oracle's was not affected. You know, just pretty much anything that used OpenSSL, which was actually a lot of things.
Right, a lot of things, but the way the media has been playing it off, it's like, oh my god, all SSL is broken.
Mm-mm. Yeah, no, it's not all SSL.
Not
but it was out there long enough that it's made it into several production systems. So, you know, for example, some of the machines I was testing, Dell printers have the vulnerability.
Oh, so the last print job or whatever that's still in memory.
I was getting nothing off of them. I'd run
a
couple hundred requests against a Dell printer. I got jack. Occasionally get the oddball line here and there where somebody was connecting to it to set up a job, but I never got any contents. They just weren't busy enough, and they had enough RAM to kind of null space it out. Now, if I left something just running on that, hammering one of these boxes, logging the output, I might eventually be able to find something, sure, but I think I just happened to get it when nobody was printing kind of thing.
Okay.
Dell printers are vulnerable. Several web servers are vulnerable. But here's the fun part to think about this bug. Okay, they're going to have most of your mainstream big iron servers are going to get fixed pretty soon. You know, web servers are patching this right now. Mashable actually put together a nice list of affected websites you should immediately change your password on. And that, you know, that happened to include Facebook, Tumblr, Google, Yahoo, GoDaddy, LastPass, SoundCloud, just to include a few. But those guys are going to get that fixed, you know, here in a few weeks. It's something I've been doing at work. We're getting as much fixed as we can. Polycom phones, by the way, were vulnerable to this.
Wow.
You could see the digits that were dialed? Or?
Well, they got a little web interface, and I occasionally was able to get chunks of the web interface, but I never got anything more than that, so it wasn't terribly useful.
Okay.
And again, these things weren't very busy. So I was mostly getting null off these things. But some of these email boxes that are constantly running, oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
I was able to pull some very interesting information off those in my own testing. So, and you know, if you want to know how to do it, when we get to Digital Dojo, I've got the Python script up and using.
Yeah, definitely. That was going to be one of my next questions.
Yeah, it's in Dojo. So,
cool.
But there's actually quite a lot of stuff out there for looking for this bug. Nessus has a plugin, Nmap has a plugin, Metasploit has a plugin, and mostly they're just going to tell you, yes, the box is vulnerable. This SSL test Python script will actually give you the memory dump.
Cool.
So, you know, you don't have to go code something up yourself, and it works fine. And I didn't have any problems, you know, like crashing servers or anything like that with this. So, and I happened to see, just as I was putting together the notes, people are starting to ask, well, what about clients that use OpenSSL? And there were some people testing it, and yeah, if you've got a bad server, you know, somebody abusing SSL on the server, things like curl and wget were apparently, you know, doing the memory leak as well.
So you can do it the other way too.
Yeah, but that's going to be really different to set up, because setting up a service that uses SSL is trivial. But of course, you know, anybody can connect to it if you've got a proper public cert. But trying to do this to a client, you got to have the connection open and going. Maybe VPN clients. I'm thinking, you know, stuff
VPN
like
that. Well, I was thinking, what about like a honeypot? What if you put out a service out there with, you know, SSH open or something, and people are connecting to it trying to brute force password? Can you read their memory then? Or does it, you like said, the connection has to be established so they would actually need legitimate creds?
Yeah, pretty much. You I don't know that you need legitimate creds to establish an SSL tunnel, a TLS tunnel. But as my understanding is, OpenSSH was not affected, because it only uses the OpenSSL library for generating certificates, not any.
Oh, okay.
This is an error in the network code, not in the certificate generation. The number, the random numbers it generates are good. It's the network code that has the bug.
Okay.
So, but there's like lots of add-ons for your browser. Is this website vulnerable or not? And there's some websites out there for testing it. Heartbleed has a link to several of them. Heartbleed.com for people to, if you want to test a web server to see if it's vulnerable to this or not. The thing I wonder about with some of these online tests is, are you giving somebody a notice that, hey, my server's vulnerable? You know, that kind of thing?
That would be a pretty valuable service. Hey, let's compile compile a list of all the vulnerable sites.
Yeah. So there's that. But, I mean, it's just, oh, man, I've not gotten much done because of this. Although it's pretty interesting. If you play around with it and you happen to find a handful of servers that are vulnerable to it, it's really interesting. I would say, though, if you go hunt down the Python script or any of the other tests out there, because the proof of concept code is not hard to find, you probably want to stick to stuff you have permission to test, because I could see some people really freaking out, and this thing is really easy to look for if you know what you're doing with an IDS. Kind of, actually, now that I think about it. IDS...
It's big enough. All the major manufacturers are going to have signatures for it anyway.
Well, except the problem is you have to establish the TLS connection first.
So you're saying it actually might be, it's within the tunnel.
It's encrypted.
They'd have to do some sort of SSL strip.
You got to do the man in the middle on your IDS. Now, a lot of IDS guys offer that. So, you know, if you've got something in front of it and you've got your cert set up for doing the SSL man in the middling, you can catch it fairly simply, because it's really dumb in the packet to catch it. It's like, oh, look, the message and the link don't match. And most of these tools, they're not generating a new heartbeat packet. They've got it hard-coded right there in the code. You know, the hex is just there. So,
right.
You know, it'd be easy to look for the packet. The problem is that it's inside a SSL connection. So,
that makes sense.
And I have a feeling you're going to see more and more stuff that's looking for this kind of thing, specifically because of all the tools and how easy this is to do. But, you know, Nmap looks for it, MassScan can look for it now, Nessus, Metasploit, and plenty of custom scripts out there looking for it. And I don't know if anybody's played with, have you ever played with MassScan before, Sard?
MassScan.
MassScan. It's a little offshoot scanner, and it's like a TCP SYN scanner only. But that thing is fast.
Oh yeah.
I was Look scanning our class B in like 10 minutes.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, I threw it into Google real quick. The first one is, this is the fastest internet port scanner. It can scan the entire internet in under 6 minutes.
Yeah, the
Which.
reason mine was taking so long is because I was running it out of a VM.
Wow.
And you're saying a Class B taking 10 minutes to scan was taking a long time? Because I SSH'd into a couple of other boxes to do some data center testing. It's like, boom, done. It's like, oh, wow. I mean, holy crap.
Wow. Interesting. You're looking for a specific port then? I mean, are you like, did you, what were you scanning for? Like just 22?
443.
Or, oh, 443. Okay.
Yeah,
that,
SSH
I
is
keep
not
getting it
affected.
confused. It's not related to SSH. It's all SSL TLS. Okay.
You beat
I
me to the
gotcha now.
URL. Fair enough. Anyways. Oh no, we've just created a monster. We just gave Cycros that link. Cycros is going to have a phone call from his ISP here real soon. Yeah, we see your cell phone is scanning the entire internet and melting our towers. Would you stop that, please? So.
Not again. I keep telling it to quit doing that. That's weird.
I don't know, man. It's got to be this antivirus I just installed. I heard most of those on Android were fake.
Yeah.
Hey, did anybody else see the fake? I didn't put the story in the notes, but just thinking about that. Anybody else see the fake
Yeah,
Android scanner?
Yeah, it was like the
top-selling
number one.
paid app for
Yeah.
like a week or something like that.
Yeah.
What is it?
It was an app that somebody threw on the Android store. Basically, all it was a button. You know, you open up the app, and there's a big button in the middle of the screen. You click it, and it says your phone is now protected. That's all there was to the app. It didn't actually do any protection, didn't change any settings. It was just a button.
Button and a
And
message.
it was the top-selling app on the Play Store for like a week.
What, he was selling it for like $4 or something, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, he made a bank off of a, you know, here's your message. I hope you feel good. I mean.
Why can't any of us actually do get something like that?
Morals. I feel
that's a lot of money.
It is a lot. Well, that and the fact that I wouldn't have expected it to work. I'd be sitting there, you know, if I was trying to put something like that together, it's like, okay, it's got to raise the CPU load for a little bit. It's got to look like it's doing something. It has to touch some files in the system. It's like, no, you just hit a button. It does nothing.
But why not make an app like that, that when you push the button, it just shuts off all network connections? There, your phone is safe.
There you go.
Well, wasn't there when the iPhone came out that somebody put out an app that just said, I am rich, and it was like the most expensive thing you could put in the
Yeah, it cost like $10,000,
and
like
11
two people
people
bought
bought
it.
It or something.
Yeah,
else.
It's just
Yeah,
like, why? And that one was honest. All it did was say, I'm rich. They
yeah.
at least told you what it did. So,
all for the street cred, man.
I guess.
Wow.
That's like that Wu-Tang Clan album. They're releasing one.
Oh, yeah. One album and millions of bucks or
it's
whatever.
Like, yeah, you think that's not going to be on the internet in like 10 minutes just to say screw you?
Yeah.
That's going to be funny when that happens. Anyways, let's go on to the actual news stories we picked out for the show tonight. First one up is from PCWorld.com. Jose Vidoza's 62-year-old father was using his old Windows computer when a warning in broken English flashed on the screen. Your files have been encrypted. Vidoza's father, who speaks Spanish, did not understand the warning, which demanded payment in order to decrypt the files. When Vidoza looked at it, he knew it was bad and became angry. I became upset with that, said Vidoza, who lives in the small town of Bella Vista, Argentina, and works for Tucuma Games, a video game developer. I did not want to pay, and I don't blame him. Nobody wants to pay for this crap. Vidoza's machine had just become one of the latest victims of a long-running scam that has been seen surprising resurgence over the last year. For around a decade, cybercriminals have been hacking people's computers and encrypting their files. The hackers typically demand $100 to $500 payable in Bitcoin or other web-based payment services. Okay, I'm not all aboard the Bitcoin bandwagon, but that's not fair just to lump it in and say, yeah, it's Bitcoin, because usually I see the ones asking for greenbacks.
Right.
Sard, what do you usually see?
Yeah, I agree. It's a lot of different cryptocurrencies or whatever, but it
well, there was one asking for Dogecoin, wasn't there? I mean,
I haven't seen that one. But it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, I usually see them telling you to get the green pack and, you know, do it that way. But I mean,
exactly.
You know, because this is kind of saying, oh, it's Bitcoin. Bitcoin bad. But,
yeah, it's that stigma of it being some silent secret, like, hacker currency or something.
Yeah. The ransom.
Didn't it used to be prepaid cards?
Or? Yeah, they tell you use prepaid cards. Although, to be fair, some of the malware specifically does say Bitcoin, and it might be that this one they're talking about does. The ransom may increase the longer the victim waits. Kevin Haley, director of Symantec Security Response Team, said Wednesday, "It's the perfect kind of criminal scam. You get people scared and not thinking, and then you can make a lot of money with it," which is true. Because I've seen people go to the store and buy the green packs because they thought, you know, they had the FBI virus or whatever it was. And, it, you know, because they're terrified and they think they have to do this now. The computer says so. So.
Right.
But Vidoza.
Computer says it's right.
Yeah, yeah. An enthusiastic 25-year-old wasn't about to give up. He launched his own investigation, discovering that his machine had first been infected with Synfit, which is a malware behind a botnet or a network of compromised computers by the same name. S-E-F-N-I-T. Sifnit? Not sure how you'd say that. Okay, so he got botted. Fine. He believes that whoever controls the Sifnit likely sold access to his computer to other cybercriminals who then installed Crypto Defense, a type of ransomware that emerged last month. Diving into Crypto Defense's code, he found the developers had made a crucial mistake. Crypto Defense used Microsoft's Data Protection API. They used the Windows built-in encryption algorithms.
Against them.
Yeah.
Wow.
A tool in the Windows operating system to encrypt users' data. Crypto Defense then sent the plain text private key to unlock the data back to its own server, and the cybercriminal would only release it upon payment. But they apparently didn't know that the Data Protection API stored a copy of the encryption keys on the victim's computer. The problem, though, is that the key is stored as on the user's systems were encrypted. the keys are encrypted. He and a researcher, Fabian Wassar, of the Australian security company EMSI Soft, maybe it's MC Soft. I'm not sure if that's pronounced or spelled out. Anyways, collaborated on a utility called the MC Soft Decryptor that could recover the keys. So they actually figured out this error for Crypto Defense and wrote a little utility. Neat. Where was I? Vidoza knew he had made a big discovery, and one that would help a lot of people. In mid-March, he launched a blog chronicling his investigation, including an email address to request assistance. At the time, he purposely withheld revealing the mistake Crypto Defense's authors had made on his blog. But then Symantec published a blog on March 21st detailing the error. Way to go, Symantec. Symantec's post described the file path where the keys were stored, but then around 2 days later, Symantec deleted that specific information. Oops. After the coding error in Crypto Defense became public, the malware authors fixed it, once again making the malware an intractable problem for those infected. Haley said he understood the argument for keeping the mistake quiet, but the cybercriminals would have figured it out eventually and closed that loop, he said. The utility developed by Vidoza and Wassar only works for versions of Crypto Defense that infected machines prior to March 31st, but it has still helped many people. So, yeah. They figured out that the Crypto Defense guys had made a pretty nasty error, wrote a utility to take advantage of the error so that they could help people get their data back without having to send somebody $500 worth of Bitcoin. And then Symantec detailed it on a blog and told the malware authors, hey, this is how we're doing it.
Dumbass.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's Symantec, so what do you expect?
Yeah, that's true. Well, it was good while it lasted.
Yeah, cold month there.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Next one up is from Ars Technica. When does an online threat become worthy of criminal prosecution? The Supreme Court is being asked to decide that unanswered question as prosecutors for online rants from Facebook to YouTube are becoming commonplace. Are people really suing people over saying shit on Facebook?
Yeah, I've heard of it before. It's slander, right? I don't know.
Well, it'd be libel, wouldn't it? I mean,
I don't know, defamation of character.
Yeah, I mean slander's spoken, but you know,
well, it's spoken. It's on the internet, man.
Well, that's technically in print.
Everyone's
isn't
on
it?
The internet.
In print, it's libel. But
ask the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Authorities are routinely applying an old world 1932 statute concerning extortion to today's online world, where words don't always mean what they seem.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I think the mafia got pretty good at using words that didn't mean what they seemed. It's like, we've had this problem before. The latest case involving the legal parameters of online speech before the justices concerns a Pennsylvania man sentenced to 50 months in prison after being convicted on 4 counts of interstate communications of threats. 50 months in prison.
Wow.
For saying shit on Facebook.
That's kind of terrifying.
Defendant Anthony Elanos's 2010 Facebook rant concerned attacks on elementary school, his estranged wife, and even law enforcement. So he went on Facebook and said he was going to shoot up a school, shoot a wife, and shoot the cops, and 50 months in jail. Oh, wow. Here's the post. I should have read the story. That's it. I've had about enough. I'm checking out and making a name for myself. Enough elementary schools in a 10-mile radius to initiate the most heinous school shooting ever imagined, and hell hath no fury like a crazy man in a kindergarten class. Wow! The only question is which one read one of Ilanus's posts. It won't be the first time the justices have been asked to resolve the issue. That's because they are regularly fresh media accounts of defendants handed lengthy prison terms for their online speech. Weeks ago, for example, another Pennsylvania man was handed up a 6-year term for a YouTube rap video threatening police officers. 6 years for a YouTube video?
Wow.
Oh, man.
Wow.
I mean, was he naming them, or is he just saying he was going to shoot cops? Because I'm pretty sure there's a whole bunch of rappers
video,
who sell albums that say that kind of stuff.
You know, I almost wonder if there was not more going on in that one. Just like, was he on probation?
Yeah.
Like, was it like a third strike or something like that?
Well,
six
if there was
years,
more going on, then they would probably have something other than just the speech.
I don't know. I mean, you're right. They could be picking and choosing to make their story look better here, but that's just, wow. 6 years for a YouTube video because he threatened police officers. I wonder if it's just they don't like the idea that you can go online and say whatever you want. And so it's like, oh, well, he threatened somebody. And I don't know.
I guess.
In the Alanis case pending before the Supreme Court, the 30-year-old contends that the authorities never proved he intended to threaten anybody. But a federal appeals court in September ruled that the standard of proof is whether a reasonable person, the target of the rant, would deem online speech threatening. They've never seen 4chan. Because I'm a reasonable person would deem that entire thing threatening. I'm just saying. So the third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld Alanis' sentence and conviction. He appealed to the Supreme Court. Whatever a so-called true threat is, it's not protected under the First Amendment. Whether online or not, other forms of speech that do not enjoy the backing of the Constitution include child pornography and obscenity. Obscenity? How do you...
It can't swear.
Be right back. I got to delete a couple of show archives.
No, it's got to be like obscene,
like
sex acts or like, something like that, right?
I'm guessing that's for
obscenity.
Like that's got to be for like snuff films or something like that.
Yeah,
I
mean. It's got to be something like that.
You know, or two girls, one cup, or whatever. I mean. the Supreme Court, a decade... Wait a minute. Does this mean we can really, really go after Fox for all those links to Blue Waffle he used to send people?
Oh, man. That dude is so screwed.
The Supreme Court, a decade ago, described truth threats in a Virginia cross-burning decision as statements where the speaker means to communicate a serious expression of intent to commit an unlawful violence... An act of unlawful violence. There's the definition. So what's an act of lawful violence? I guess it'd be a boxing match, huh? To a particular individual or a group of individuals. Clay Calvert, a scholar at the University of Florida in Gainesville, notes that the court never considered the issue in the online context. Will people discount or treat less seriously speech posted on Facebook or a video uploaded to YouTube than they would in person or traditional mediums such as newspaper or television? Yes. Have you seen Tumblr? the court has never considered how the nature of online media affects a true threat analysis, he wrote. In his petition to the Supreme Court, Ilanis' counsel said the issue boils down to whether a person can be convicted of the felony of speech crime of making a threat only if he subjectively intended to threaten another person, or whether he can be convicted if he negligently misjudged how his words would be constructed or construed and a reasonable person would deem it a threat. I'm not good at the lawyer speak tonight. Only one federal appeals court has sided with Alanis's conviction that the has sided with Alanis's contention that the authorities must prove that the person who made the threat actually meant to carry it out. Eight other circuit courts of appeal, however, have ruled that the standard is whether a reasonable person would conclude the threat was real. It won't be the first time the justices faced a case asking the same question as presented in Alanis's petition. The High Court, without ruling last year, let stand an 18-month term handed to an Iraqi war veteran whose prosecutor said he posted a 2010 YouTube video threatening to kill a Tennessee judge unless the judge granted visitation rights to his daughter. Defendant Franklin Jeffries II said he never intended to carry out the threat, but the justices declined to review his case. The Obama administration has until April 21st to respond to Ilanis' petition to the Supreme Court. In the veteran's case, however, the administration urged the High Court to reject the case. So I'm going to stop reading that there. Pretty much, it's come up again, and it's going to go to the Supreme Court, whether, you know, this guy was very colorful threats to, you know, saying he was going to go shoot up schools. I don't know. When I see stuff on Facebook and blogs or whatever, I'm just kind of like, idiot, whatever. They're right. Sitting behind a keyboard typing. It's not like they're shouting it into a microphone or lighting a cross on somebody's lawn on fire.
What you post
I heard
online.
What you said.
Hi, Fox. you way to crash your show there, man. You're only, what, an hour late?
We do things on time around here?
I try.
Oh.
Well, the original recording was on time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the case, isn't it?
Did someone forget to hit the big shiny button?
I hit the big shiny button, but it decided it would record my internal sound card, which is not hooked up to anything as opposed to the correct one. So.
But this is obviously going to, I don't know. I guess you could take it as like anything that you post online, be it your Facebook, be it a blog, is like a legally binding contract that, you know, if you type, I'm going to go to the park today, you better go to the fucking park today or else we're going to sue your ass.
Well, one, there should probably be at least two things. One, the person is actually directing the post at the person they're threatening, so.
Well, you could say this guy was, because his post was talking about how many kindergarten schools are in a 10-mile radius. That is getting kind of specific.
But second, there should also, they should see if he actually takes anything, actually looks like he's going to do it versus just saying something. Is he stocking up on weaponry?
Did he upload a YouTube video of him sitting there loading the shotgun? I mean,
yeah, real intent rather than just, oh, hey guys, you know.
You said something.
Yeah.
500 years.
Well, I mean, how often do you hear, you know, people say, oh, I'll fucking kill you for that? They don't mean that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if everybody followed through with everything they said online, I would have plowed Sard's mom so many times.
Well, again, just like in real content, in real life, if somebody says they're going to kill you, and I'll just say it casually, you're not going to really think they're going to kill you. If they're coming at you with a knife saying it, bit different content.
Well, okay, I mean, there is the thing of context gets lost in online posts.
Yeah. Well, in any text,
it's really
it has no
hard.
Emotion.
It's really hard to convey sarcasm on Facebook. It's really hard to be like, "Ho ho ho, hey guys," you know.
Yeah,
I mean, it this just shows like the rampant pussification and automatic knee jerk reaction of people these days. Where, oh my God, think of the children.
Well, you missed the part where we were talking the sentences. This guy's got 50 months in prison for a Facebook post.
That's a little over 4 years.
Yeah. Person got 6 years for a rap video.
On YouTube, yeah. Because it made threats against cops. Which it's like, really? You might want to look at a whole bunch of published rap for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many artists would be serving time for just the lyrics?
Yeah. So I'm just saying that this is getting out of hand. And yeah. I mean,
yeah, this is already out of hand.
The problem is, how do you tell if you've got a genuine crazy on the hand who's, you know, growing a mullet? And wait, what is? I'm not sure where the mullet part comes from.
Is that way he might be able to construct the bomb or whatever out of a rubber band and a paperclip?
Yeah, you know, I was going somewhere with that joke, and I don't know. But you know, screw the joke. I screwed it up. But, you know, I mean, I guess how do you know whether you've got somebody who's just venting online versus somebody who's, you know, serious about it?
Again,
you kind of got to look at it from, like, the law enforcement perspective. If somebody were to go say something like that and they did nothing and the person did, people would be losing their jobs. Like, people would be getting in a lot of trouble. So this is probably more a case of people just covering their asses.
Well, that could
versus
be.
Just overreacting.
Well, okay. I mean, you're part of it, too, is, you know, I'm referencing Tumblr and Facebook, or not Facebook, but 4chan. With Facebook, there's a name attached.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the other websites I'm thinking of when you talk about crazy crap online, there's usually not much of a name attached, so it's kind of hard to construe who it is. But, you know, it kind of seems to me like, you know, if you post something stupid on Facebook and then a cop knocks on your door, you know, I would think that would scare most people to the point that they're not going to do, you know, like, oh, shit, man, I was just venting. Sorry. I mean, don't you think that a reasonable person could construe whether or not they were.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, it's a cop showing up and they piss themselves. You know, it's like, oh, shit, I was just kidding. I you know.
But then again, I bet you a reasonable person wouldn't be going onto Facebook saying they're going to go shoot up an elementary school.
Well, how do you define reasonable?
Well, you look at the average IQ of your Facebook user, and it's not really in the whole, like, I can foresee consequences of my actions.
Well, like, you got the idiots who post dubs on 4chan besides my Facebook stat.
Well, before you go into saying for people, your average person, like, saying that they'll shoot up at elementary school, go back and listen to all of IHN. I'm sure there's more than enough threats there to convict us all.
Don't give them ideas.
Don't tell them.
So.
Delete the server maps.
Yeah,
but I mean, the whole thing, like, especially using that rap thing as an example. Oh, he rapped against cops, so therefore he's gonna go out and kill a bunch of cops. Like, that's just a load of horseshit. Like, what kind of judge in his right mind would, like, you made a rap music video about shooting cops? So did, like, every other black rapper from the 90s. Fuck the police. You know, it was like the main lyric of a song. I don't think the police have been, you know, sodomized in any way, shape, or form.
What you mean as an organization, or?
Well, you know, individually by the whoever the hell sang that.
Well, all right. I don't know.
I'm not familiar with my raps.
I don't know. I just I see this, and of course my knee jerk is like, wait a minute, you, that's censorship. But I guess at the same time, you know, Suave has a good point that if the crazy was on there posting, I'm going to do this, and they actually went and did it. Yeah.
Yeah, people would lose their shit.
Well, again, yeah,
Go
ahead, BSB.
Should be more than just the post that gets them arrested. It should maybe put up a warning flag.
Well, I could see the post being used as justification to get a warrant to go see if they've got, like, a stockpile of weapons or something to show intent, but
there should be something more than just a post that gives you a 5-year sentence.
This guy posted a YouTube video with a rebel flag in the background. That's justification for. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
So I mean, I kind of worry about the slippery slope, but at the same time, I mean, I don't know. If you got a genuine crazy on your hands, you kind of would like to see them you know, caught before they've done a whole bunch of bad. So, I don't know.
Well, I just don't think that the punishment fits the crime in this case.
Well, that's certainly true.
It's a like massive organization. Like, send the guy to fucking therapy, or you know, get him a psych eval. Like, don't throw him in jail for 5 years, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, I mean, the whole institutionalize him there. That's actually not a bad idea at all. Because then you can have a psychiatrist, you know, examine them and say, oh, no, this guy was just, you know, venting. As opposed to somebody's like, okay, this guy's actually crazy. We, it's like we found him in the bathroom making voodoo dolls out of the paper towels and trying to set them on fire with the power outlet. So, I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, that's some a different level of crazy right there. Of course, then they can just go on Tumblr and, you know, fill the... next story. This one's from Torrent Freak. In common with many other countries around the world, downloading music and movies is hugely popular in the Netherlands. Surveys estimate that a third of the population downloads copyrighted content without paying for it. The other two-thirds just lie about it. Contrary to most other countries, however, downloading and copying movies and music for personal use is not punishable by law. In return, the Dutch compensate rights holders through a piracy levy on writable media, hard drives, and electronic devices with storage capability, including smartphones. Doesn't Canada do that? Don't they have a tax on CDRs and hard drives and shit like that?
Yeah, I believe we do.
So,
although you can also be sued, just not for as much. Like there's a cap of $5,000 per lawsuit.
Right, because you are compensating artists, but the Netherlands was doing something similar, and they were just saying, well, since we're compensating you, you can't sue anybody.
Yeah.
In a landmark ruling, the European Court of Justice has declared that this system is unlawful. The case was brought by several electronic stores and manufacturers whose products were made more expensive because of the levy. In its judgment, the courts held that the levy system is a threat to the internal market and that it puts copyright holders at an unfair disadvantage. If member states were free to adopt legislation permitting inter alia reproductions for private use to be made from an unlawful source, the result of all that would clearly be detrimental to the proper functionings of the internal market, the court noted in a brief on the verdict today. Similarly, the object of proper support and the dissemination of culture may not be achieved by sacrificing strict protection of copyright or by tolerating illegal forms of distribution of counterfeited or pirated works. Wow. As a result, the court ruled that the Dutch system in which people are permitted to copy files from pirated sources cannot be tolerated. The court believes that legalizing file sharing encourages the distribution of counterfeit and pirated works. In addition, it explains that a system poses an unfair disadvantage to copyright holders. The court further notes that the Dutch system also punishes those who buy their digital movies and music from authorized sources, as they also pay the piracy levy on devices and media they record them to. All users are indirectly penalized since they necessarily contribute towards the compensation payable for the harm caused by private reproductions made from an unlawful source. Users consequently find themselves required to bear an additional non-negligible cost in order to make private copies, the court notes. Today's judgment also is likely to affect other European countries with similar systems, such as Switzerland, where downloading pirated works for personal use is also permitted. Ironically, copyright holders may be worse off in the Netherlands, as it does indeed outlaw, as the Netherlands does indeed outlaw downloading pirated material. This would result in millions of euros lost in revenue through the piracy levy, which may be hard to match by an increase in legal sales, if there's any increase at all. Yeah, so they figured it out that, well, you know, it's not like all these people are going to go out and just start buying stuff. Update. The Dutch government has confirmed to Tweakers that downloading copyrighted material for personal use is no longer allowed, effective immediately. The government also clarified that in general offenses will be prosecuted through civil cases, not criminal. So, yeah, pretty much the EU court said, no, you can't run the system that way, and they said okay. But, yeah, so they've just declared, no, we're not going to do these general, you know, compensation systems. You cannot do file sharing.
You know, it's not a bad approach, just looking at it. Like, you can't stop people from pirating stuff. There's just no way. So, like, you know, trying to come up with a solution that still makes sure that people are paying in some way or another is not a bad idea, but I can definitely see how this could definitely be causing problems with the local economy. Because if you have a local music store that has to tack on like a 10% charge onto everything they sell, well, people are just going to hop online and buy it from, you know, the UK or something and have it shipped over and save money.
Well, that's
very
true.
Good point. Yeah.
I don't know. I just I don't like
other countries telling one country their system is illegal.
Yeah, I don't much care for that. I also don't
especially
much
when
care.
Don't give a
go no. ahead. Swolf.
I was just going to say, especially when they don't give a good alternative.
Yeah. I don't like this concept of, you know, this copyright is such a sacred thing, because I don't think it is. I mean, copyright is important. It is important for very legitimate creative reasons. You want to be able to protect your works, but at the same time, it's gotten so bloated and so over-enforced and so aggressive.
Out of proportion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like it's, you know, the fair use is a thing. I do a lot of audio stuff on the side as a hobby, and it turns out that taking sound clips from movies and using them in audio tracks for like music, that's for the most part legal. You know, it's that kind of sampling is fine, and the movie studios have gotten so good at suing about it, even though it's technically allowed under fair use, that people don't do it anymore, because you know, it's considered a transformative work. It's considered a different medium. It's not a straight copy. You're doing something with it, but you know, it doesn't matter that should technically be allowed under the law. They sue you into the ground anyways and still get their way. So, any time I see copyright being more strongly enforced, I it's a knee jerk thing, but it's like, so.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Next story. Like, say what?
I was just saying, like, you know, you look at the consequence of it, like when they're suing these people for more than they make in, you know, 5 years for like three songs, it's ridiculous. Like, if these people got charged like the fair value of the song, like, oh, you know, for a paid download for this song was like $1.99. If you had to pay that plus your court fees or whatever, like, it would be a little bit more reasonable.
Well, hell, the court fees would be right back up there to where.
Yeah. But when they're suing for like, you know, $1 million for a fucking song or whatnot. Yeah.
Well, didn't they try to sue LimeWire for more money than actually existed?
Something like that, yeah.
Yes. Freaking retarded.
$1 trillion.
Billion dollars.
And also, one of the main things with the owners of it, it's make your stuff more easily accessible and maybe people actually pay you for it versus actually give people a good choice instead of pay an arm and a leg or get it for free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very true.
All right, let's go to the next one here. This one is from the BBC. The EU Data Retention Directive was adopted in 2006. The European Court of Justice today says it violates two basic rights, respect for private life and protection of personal data. The EU-wide ruling was prompted by Australian and Irish complaints. That's not Australian, that's Austrian. So RU has every right to get mad at me for misreading that. The 28-nation EU is currently drafting a new data protection law. The ECJ ruling says that the 2006 directive allowing storage of data on a person's identity, the time that person's communication and the place from which the communication took place, and the frequency of that person's communications. The directive allowed the storage of all that. By requiring the retention of those data and allowing the competent national authorities to access the data, the directive interferes with a particularly serious matter with the fundamental rights to respect for private life and the protection of personal data, said the court in Luxembourg. The UK government said it is carefully considering the implications of the ruling, the BBC's Chris Moore supports. Austrian and Irish courts had asked the ECJ to decide whether the directive complied with the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. The judges acknowledged that data retention was justified in the fight against serious crime and to safeguard public security, but they argued that the directive was disproportionate. They also said the data was used without an individual's knowledge is likely to generate in the person's concerned a feeling that their private lives are subject to constant surveillance. The directive does not provide sufficient safeguards against possible abuse of personal data, the judges said, and there was insufficient clarity concerning the basis for holding data for a minimum of 6 months or a maximum of 2 years, they argued. So, you know, the EU court gets it crazy in the one case, and then they seem to get it right in this one, saying, okay, this is overbroad, we've got to readdress it. So, I don't know what the hell's going on over there. So, I guess...
Yeah, I was going to say, like you said, man, that some people get it, other people don't. Unfortunately, those people are judges and they pass rulings on this shit.
Yeah. All right, that's, I guess nobody, yeah, that one's just kind of a, next story. This one is, what'd I hit? Okay. This one is from Bloomberg.com. The Mt. Gox company principal Mark Karpels is beyond the reach of a U.S. court where he and the bankrupt Bitcoin exchange are being sued for the consumer fraud by two American depositors, his attorney told the federal judge. So his lawyer is arguing in court, you guys just can't get to him. It's like, he's out of your reach, man. Karpels and Tidbane KK, another of his companies named in the lawsuit filed in Chicago federal court in February, will submit papers asking U.S. District Judge Gary Fainerman to rule he has no jurisdiction over them, according to lawyer Eric Macy said in court today. Karpels, who lives in Japan, has never been to the U.S. and wasn't properly served with the complaint that's started the suit, Macy said after today's proceedings. Fainerman gave the lawsuit or gave the lawyer until April 28th to file papers making his arguments. Once the world's biggest Bitcoin exchange, Mt. Gox filed for bankruptcy in Tokyo on February the 28th after announcing it could not account for more than 700,000 customer Bitcoins, plus 100,000 of its own, and halted client withdrawals. The company has since said it located about 200,000 of the missing coins and that the balance valued at more than $268 million at today's price might have been stolen. Each unit of you... What was this one? Sorry.
I was going to go, dun, dun, dun. Anyways.
Each unit of the virtual currency is worth $446.83 today, according to the trade tracking value Coindesk. We think there's jurisdiction, Jay Elderson, the depositor's attorney, told Fainerman today. Depositors Greg Green of Illinois, who claim he lost about access to about $25,000 worth of currency, and Joseph Lack, who allegedly lost about $40,000, have accused Shibuya Ku, Japan-based Mt. Gox, its U.S. affiliate Karpels, and Tibane of fraud. Mt. Gox filed papers on March 9th at the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Dallas seeking American court's recognition of its status in Japan and temporarily preventing the pursuit of creditors in the U.S. Fainerman last month said he'd blocked the Chicago plaintiffs from proceeding against the Japanese business while allowing them to move forward against the U.S. affiliate, Karpels and the other defendants. The judge also issued an order freezing those defendants' U.S. assets. So, yeah.
Yeah, the Mt. Gox is almost old news. Like, I think everybody... well aware of how screwed up the situation is and how nobody's ever going to get anything back from that. No. Like, even if they were within jurisdiction, like, okay, what are you going to do? You're going to sue somebody for something that they no longer hold? Or if they do hold, it's so buried that you'll never find it?
Well, there's that.
Yeah. The only chances of something actually coming through is if the government had money involved. Then he would on U.S. soil by now.
Yeah.
Snowden.
I love every story now that mentions the 200,000 missing coins that they supposedly found, like when they, you know, lifted up the couch cushions at Mount Gox. Like, oh, that's where I put those bitcoins.
I'm getting a new couch this weekend. I'm afraid of what I'm going to find under mine.
Just burn it.
Just burn it.
Oh, man, it's just Litecoin.
You know. Oh, look at all these Litecoins under my couch. I have a cat.
I don't remember
God knows
having another
I'm
cat.
Find couch. I found the cat's Bitcoin mining rig. Damn.
Damn.
All right. let's see. Next story up is from the BBC and is funny. In many jobs, work email does not stop when the employee leaves the office. And now France has decided to act. It has introduced rules to protect about 1 million people from working in the digital and or from people working in the digital and consultatory sectors from work email outside of office hours. Those are to be taken before 9 a.m. and after 6 p.m. The deal signed between Employers Federation and Union says that employees will have to switch off work phones and avoid looking at work email, while firms cannot pressure staff to check messages. Michael De La Force, chairman of the General Confederation of Managers, has said that digital working time would have to be measured. Some emailing outside of office hours would be allowed, but only in exceptional circumstances. It's email, people. Digital wow. working time.
Does the internet turn off in France between 6 p.m.
Yeah.
and
I don't
9 a.m.?
Well,
that's
crazy.
They
surrender
their throughput in Germany.
It gets better. France has a 35-hour work week adopted in 1998. Lucky bastards. But the French are not alone in worrying about how portable devices have exposed employees to longer hours. In December of 2011, Volkswagen announced that servers would stop sending emails 30 minutes after the end of employee shifts and only start again half an hour before the person returned to work. The move was followed by Germany's labor ministry. In the UK, there is protection for many type of workers in the form of the working time regulations, but the TUC argues this simply doesn't cover out-of-hours email, and there are exemptions for categories of workers like lawyers and doctors. If an out-of-hours email ban was brought in, the situation could be similar and not everyone would be protected, said Andrew Liley, an employment lawyer and managing partner at the law firm Travers Smith. I imagine many jobs would be exempt a bit like some of the exemptions in the working time regulations. Disruptive email is mainly a white-collar problem, you think. it goes through the territory for certain jobs, such as lawyer or financier, where the staff are managing their own time. But others further down the hierarchy working on fixed-hour contracts are perhaps also in need of protection. I mean, talk about inventing your problems here. Technology has redrawn the working day. Woody Allen's 1972 film Play It Again, Sam contains a running gag about a workaholic businessman played by Tony Roberts. He begins every scene by phoning the office to give the telephone number where he can be reached and for how long, followed by the next contact number. He was the exception. Workers used to be able to disappear. Today, anyone with a smartphone is usually reachable. Michael Reed, an IT teacher at the Liverpool Comprehensive, says his evenings are regularly interrupted. An email arrives at 11:45 p.m. and you know a colleague is working late and you want to support them. When he sees it in his inbox, he is crestfallen, he says. It takes the joy out of what you were doing.
Dude, this is...
Kill yourself. No.
So...
it's called self-control. I fucking hate those. I've heard of people that, you know, like, oh, someone's calling me. I have to pick up my phone right now because someone's calling me. The fuck you do, dude? You know how many times I mute my phone and continue on doing what the fuck I'm doing?
Yeah.
Fuck that.
Or just pretend
just
not
because...
to hear it.
Yeah, so just because work emails you off of work hours, you
it's sucking the joy out of this man's life. Yeah.
The only reason I would ever look at my work email is if someone physically called me and said, "Oh my god, look on your fucking email right now, everything's on fire."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I don't have any notifications that go off for it. When I did, I would shut them off via an app. After like 6 o'clock at night, it's like if it's that big of an issue, fucking call me.
Well, let me finish out the story here because it's hilarious. An advertising consultant in London who wants to remain anonymous says she is expected to respond to emails. Many come through between 6 o'clock and midnight. Needless to say, not all emails require immediate. I'm sorry. What was that? BSV.
10 o'clock.
Oh, you're right. That is. they switch from saying talking about 11:45 and then going to 24 hours on me, and I should be better at that. Anyways, needless to say, not all emails require an immediate response. Though, if I'm to tell which do and which don't, I do need to check them. Requests for information she accepts as part of the job. Others, can I remind you of X, or invitations to meetings with no context, drive her nuts, she says. Now she switches her phone off when she goes to bed to ensure an uninterrupted night's sleep. Enforcing an email ban would almost be impossible, argues Alif Reza, an oil analyst in Stavanger, Norway. He checks email every half hour when he leaves work at 4:30 until about 9 o'clock. That's not 9 o'clock. That's 7 o'clock. The stock market is still open, and he might get an urgent message from colleagues in London. When he wakes, he checks to see if colleagues in the U.S. or Singapore have been in touch. I don't think a ban would work. If Norway bans my company from sending emails to me, then my company needs to make sure that somebody is able to cover the requests that should have been in my inbox. The industry would find a way around it, he argues. So, you know, it's a bit silly. There is actually a very legitimate point, though, that if you've got such a workload that, you know, you get out of the office, you go home, you sit down on your computer, and you get back to work checking emails and answering stuff, maybe your company needs to hire a second person to help cover those off hours.
Yeah.
There was a legitimate point there. But the silliness of a government ban on work email after, you know, whatever time. Oh, that's really?
Really, like, you know, when you're dealing with your employer, it really comes down to your employer-employee relationship. And, you know, there's a lot of jobs and a lot of situations where, yeah, they might ask you to check your email occasionally when you're out of work. And that may be fine as long as it was made clear when you started your job and, you know, you're getting adequate compensation. But, you know, if you're, you know, being asked to do unpaid overtime and all this other sort of crap and they just don't leave you alone, that's an entirely different story. But if it's something that you're willing to do, then that's fine. But I don't think it should be forced on you. You know, like if you're in your off time, it should be your decision whether or not you're going to do it. Like you can, and it might reflect positively on you and it might just go well for you when bonuses come around. But if you don't do it, you shouldn't like lose your job.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the government ban on it. That's just silly. It's like we have to find the working hours from 9 to 6. Period. It's like, I know plenty of people who work outside of those hours.
I'm just imagining a doctor not getting a an email.
Yeah. Well,
they did say there are exemptions for people like that, but I was just thinking the whole 35-hour work week thing also. I'm going to have to ask RU next time I see him, because Australia is such the nanny state. They're probably down to at least a 20-hour work week and email between, you know, 11 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the afternoon or something.
So, I don't know. Next story is from psychcentral.com. The disturbing imagery of violent video games or violent themes of video games like World of Warcraft and Grand Theft Auto. Guys, those are not violent video games.
World of Warcraft is graphically violent?
Apparently.
I thought it had cartoony graphics.
They never played Blood, did they? what was the one I was playing the other day? That was, you want to talk about something with some nice, you know, good old fashioned horror in it? Outlast. It was Outlast. That was blood all over the walls and everything. Now that's a little bit, but anyways, Grand Theft Auto. Really, it's a cartoon. Anyways, are often accused of fostering feelings of aggression in players. But a new study shows hostile behavior is actually linked to the gamer's experiences of failure and frustration during gameplay, not a game's violent content.
You think?
Well, I love it because this study basically validates that, yes, it's the lag, not the shooting people, that makes you violent.
Yeah. Or not being able to find that, you know, 10th ring that, you know, you can never fucking find in a level or whatever to get all of them. Then you throw your remote through your TV.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see, where was I? The study is the first to look at the player's psychological experiences with video games instead of focusing solely on its content. Researchers found that failure to master a game and its controls led to frustration and aggression, regardless of whether the game was violent or not. The findings of the study are found in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Any player who has thrown down a remote control after losing an electronic game can relate to the intense feelings of anger failure can cause, said lead author Andrew Prisbilski, PhD, who said such frustration is commonly known among gamers as rage quitting.
It took a PhD to figure out rage quitting existed.
Psychros is arguing with me in the IRC that GTA is not... Every time I've played it, I mean, it's been obviously cartoonish.
Hooker murder simulator?
I mean, yeah, okay, it can look realistic, and what you're doing in it is not the nicest thing in the world, but it's obviously a cartoon. I mean, you don't... Of course, I got sci-fi shows. The Walking Dead is a cartoon, okay? A cartoon doesn't mean that it doesn't look real. It means that it's silly and outlandish and not real. So, anyways. Yeah, I don't think of GTA Grand Theft Auto as being this overly violent game, but that's
you,
just what, me.
You mean you can tell the difference between Grand Theft Auto and real life?
Apparently that's like a superpower. So that experience is not unique to gaming, said co-author Richard Ryan, a motivational psychologist at the University of Rochester. For example, in sports, players may lose a game as a bad call. When people feel they have no control over the outcome of a game, that leads to aggression, he said. We saw in our experiments that if you press someone's competencies, they'll become more aggressive, and our efforts held up whether the games were violent or not. To determine which aspects of the gaming experience led to aggressive feelings, the researchers manipulated the interface controls and degree of difficulty in custom-designed video games across 6 lab experiments. Nearly 600 college-age participants were tasked with playing the games, many of which included violent and non-violent variations, and then were tested for aggressive thoughts, feelings, or behaviors. Across the experiments, researchers found it was not the narrative or imagery, but the lack of mastery of the game's controls and the degree of difficulty players had completing the game that led to frustration. The study demonstrated that aggression is a negative side effect of the frustration felt when playing the game. So, yeah, I just... Yeah, I love it. It's like, yes, we've scientifically proven that it's the lag that makes you violent, not the fact that you're shooting people.
Awesome. That'd be actually a pretty sweet job. Well, not job, but thing to do. 600 college students, like, hey, come here, play video games. We'll give you money for it. And when you want to throw the remote at the screen, we'll let you do it.
I want to know how they got the funding for this. I mean...
Yeah.
All right. Last news story I got for tonight is great. It's from Ars Technica. The Los Angeles Police Commission is investigating how half of the recording antennas in the Southeast Division went missing, seemingly as a way to evade the new self-monitoring procedures that the Los Angeles Police Department imposed last year. The antennas, which are mounted onto individual patrol cars, receive recorded audio captured from an officer's belt-worn transmitter. The transmitter is designed to capture an officer's voice and transmit the recording of to the car itself for storage. The voice recorders are part of a video camera system that is mounted in a front-facing camera on the patrol car. Both elements are activated any time a car's emergency lights and sirens are turned on, but they can also be activated manually. According to the Los Angeles Times, an LAPD investigation determined that around half of the 80 patrol cars in one South LA division were missing antennas as of last summer, and an additional 10 antennas were unaccounted for. They're not missing, they're unaccounted for. Citing a police source, the newspaper said that removing the antennas can reduce the range of the voice transmitters by as much as a third of the normal operating distance. The police commission, an independent body that oversees LAPD policy, was only notified of the situation 2 months ago. Neither the commission nor LAPD immediately responded for content. On an issue like this, we need to be brought in right away, Commission President Steve Sorboff told the Times. This equipment is for the protection of the public and of the officers. And to have people who don't like the rules to take it upon themselves to do something like this is very troubling. The self-monitoring has been imposed by the LAPD as a result of federal monitoring of its police activities that formally ended last year after more than a decade. An LAPD spokesperson Commander Andrew Smith told the Times that the new rules since last fall require patrol officers to account for both antennas at the beginning and end of every shift with an additional unaccounted spot or unannounced spot check. Since then, only one antenna has gone missing. It's just like, really, is anybody surprised that if the police are going to do something bad that they, you know, they're going to know where their cameras and their voice recorders are and they're going to take actions to protect themselves before they do anything off the books?
It's a real mystery.
My question is, are these guys retarded? Didn't the story say that they are active when the sirens and lights are on?
Yep.
So what's to stop the police from, like, you know, turning off their lights after they pull someone over? And that's that. Like, it's I don't really understand. Is there like maybe a delay where it stays recording for a while after you turn it off, or what? Because like really, like why would you need to remove the antenna if you could just turn off your lights?
I think you nailed it on the head.
I have no idea.
You're retarded.
But I just love the headline: LAPD officers monkey wrenched cop monitoring gear. So it's.
You know, I'm a little bit torn on this because, like, you know, I'm a big protect. Like, I'm really big for privacy, and you know, like saying, oh, well, they should totally be monitored all the time because it's good for our safety because they might be doing something bad, and then go around and say I don't like being monitored because I might be doing something bad, is kind of a little bit hypocritical. What? I guess you could say though that like they are public servants and they are on the job.
What?
And you know, like while I'm on the job at work, I fully accept the fact that somebody could like hop on my computer at any time over the network and check out what I'm doing. Like that's just something that you accept.
Yeah.
They should be monitored while working, I think. If you shouldn't have to monitor them while they're off duty.
Well, that's true. You know, I actually cut the story in half for the show notes. It goes on talking about how they, at one point, we're talking about putting GPS trackers on cop cars, and the cops didn't like that. And they talked to a couple officers saying how they don't like being tracked all the time. They you know, all this other stuff. And I just thought it was really ironic that you had all these government people saying, well, we don't want to be tracked all the time. Really? You don't say.
We're going to track the shit out of you, though.
Yeah.
So the people we lawfully give guns and all that to and expect to uphold the law don't want to be kept track of.
Well, they justify it in the story a little bit. It's like, well, what if you're meeting a contact and you're worried about exposing them, or you're dealing with it, you know, internal corruption or whatever? And it's like, well, I'm sure there's
should be showing up fully uniformed in a cop car.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's such a special circumstance.
So I don't know. I'm just like, really, you're surprised? Although I will tell you, I've served on a jury before, and the cop car's, you know, recordings, that was the only evidence we need, because the guy was owning up to everything right there on the video. You know what I mean? So, I don't, you know, if they're acting legit, I don't know why they'd want to turn this stuff off. Because, I mean, that's protecting them, for one, showing, nope, they didn't do anything wrong. See, look, there's the video. Plus, you know, you get everything the guy says on tape. So
again, it's only the people that don't, aren't doing the correct thing that don't really want it. If you're doing your job correctly as a law enforcer officer, you'd have no worry of being recruited.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, it's just like, really, anybody surprised that they're doing this? So
not really.
Anyways.
I'm just confused why they would be so sloppy as to lose 10 of the antennas.
I have a feeling it's people who don't really understand what's going on with the equipment, and they've just figured out if they bust the antenna, it doesn't look like they were turning the because it's still recording, right? It's like, oh, I just went out of range. So,
well, if you break the antenna, it should be on the books as
I was driving to the ghetto and they threw something at my car, totally broke the antenna.
Totally.
Well, sure, but I mean, yeah, I can see that argument that it's like, well, it's not my fault the radio transmitter wasn't working, but still. So, all right, let's move on to this. All right, for Digital Dojo. I got a couple of things tonight. First thing up, we've got at github.com, we've got the Shinobi script that I was using for all my Heartbleeder testing. It's a Python script you can use to test for the Heartbleed vulnerability. Since this one shows the entire dump that comes back, you can potentially use it to find other things, and you should only run this script against things you have permission to test. Pretty much, if you want to find it, it's the gist.github.com/shinobi, or SH1N0B1. It's one of his scripts in there. He's got a couple of forks of it, actually. He's got one with built-in looping, so you can tell it to do 100 pulls. And I would explore some of the other forks people have done of the script, see what they're doing. I saw one that was somebody had forked it and was specifically looking for session cookies, and I'm sure there's all kinds of other stuff like that. So if you want to have some fun with the Heartbleeder bug before all the big stuff gets patched, that's definitely a way to go. The other thing to keep in mind with this Heartbleeder bug, and I meant to talk about it earlier, think how many devices that this is embedded into and it's not going to get patched ever. You know, printers and routers and just, you know, little forgotten boxes that somebody's not even realizing is still running on the network, and there it is. So I don't know about DDWRT routers. You'd have to test it. So go on to github.com, grab the script, and test it. Did I lose TeamSpeak?
No, man.
No.
Okay, it was just quiet.
Very quiet.
Yep, sorry, man.
We'll listen contently.
I definitely want to try out that Python script.
Yeah, and it's great fun. You find a server it works on.
Yeah.
So the last thing I have for Digital Dojo is at CommodorePi.co.nr. And this is a project to develop a native Commodore 64 emulator that runs as a operating system on the Raspberry Pi. It's not like loading an emulator on top of Linux. It's in, it's a bare metal emulator on the Raspi to emulate a Commodore 64. And they're hoping to get what they're hoping to achieve is nearly instant on, you know, output to HDMI and composite. Use the GPIO pins to connect to external drives. I wonder if that means like the original Commodore drives and stuff like that. Of course, support Ethernet, USB, full access to the RAM of the Pi, multitasking, and modern graphics modules, but they still want it to be a freaking Commodore 64, which is actually kind of awesome.
That's cool.
So the project is supposed to be a Commodore 64 operating system. It's they're basing it on one of the emulators, and you know they want to be able to do SID sound, sprites, joystick connectivity, everything. And it doesn't look like it's anywhere near done, but it's a very fun idea. So it's a very low-level, bare metal Commodore emulator. It's not running Linux, you know, and then emulating or anything like that. So that's pretty much all I got. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Peer decking every Thursday. I don't know what the deal is with Shoot the Noise. I thought we were bringing that back on a, you know, maybe every other week basis. Missing Dialogues, I need to get with Laura and see what's going on with that. Yugo, we need to talk about your show and figure out what we want to do with that. Of course, I have nothing every Saturday. They got hit up the Galaxy 15 radio site, the Twitter handle, the feedback form, the IRC channel, and the subreddit if you want to give us feedback. Worst case scenario, I understand Big is still accepting TCP/IP via Carrier Pigeon. So,
excellent.
Excellent, yes.
Next meetup, that's happening. I'm fishing out stuff.
Next meetup, he's going to hand me all these dead birds. I'm like, here!
I got these. These are all the ones they
wouldn't stop, man.
Nice.
So, anyways. That's really all I've got. So, I'm going to close out with actually a track I made. So, unless anybody else has anything they want to throw out before I hit play on this music here.
Okay.